Today on Annenberg Radio News.
Thank you all. Go upstairs and kick back.
Yeah. Homeless veterans are thrilled to have a new place to live. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Monday, September 29th, 2014. I'm Charlie McGovern. City leaders from around the world are in Los Angeles to exchange ideas for solving urban problems. Our Kylie Morgan dropped in on their discussions this morning, and she has this report.
Hundreds of people are gathered at the Marriott Hotel in downtown, where this year's City Lab event is being held. The three-day event gives city leaders and entrepreneurs a chance to share innovative ways to solve old problems. Mayor Eric Garcetti spoke about LA's solutions to chronic problems, such as traffic and parking.
City Lab is the place where mayors and city leaders can come together and actually find solutions that are common across all of our different jurisdictions. And I love it because you suddenly become mayor and nobody gives you the rule book of how it gets done.
This event offers the equivalent of a crash course on running a city, with discussions covering topics like immigration and income inequality. There are mayors and city planners and industry representatives from cities throughout the United States and the world. But City Lab is especially useful for Los Angeles, where Garcetti hopes to take advantage of the city's local resources. LA Deputy Mayor Rick Cole says Los Angeles has a unique advantage when it comes to using local entrepreneurs to solve citywide problems.
Los Angeles is a famously decentralized city. For cities that are more traditional, New York, Chicago, that has always seemed a disadvantage. I think it's more of an advantage in the digital age. There's much greater spreading of power.
Tomorrow, panelists will discuss immigration and LA's film industry. Kylie Morgan, Annenberg Radio News.
If you own a helicopter, you're going to have fewer parking spots going forward. City officials announced today that buildings will no longer require rooftop helicopter landing stations. LA was the only major city that had this rule, which has been in place for over 30 years. The change aims to make the LA skyline less flat and more visually appealing. Several dozen homeless veterans picked up keys today to new apartments. They'll be living at the historic Roslyn Hotel in downtown Los Angeles. Dana Beth Solomon tagged along with some of the new tenants.
Yay! All right!
Lionel Muldrew is unlocking the door to his new apartment for the first time. It's a big step up after 6 years living on the streets near the Staples Center.
There's a refrigerator, the sink, the stove, and I think a microwave. Beautiful, beautiful. And I'm in the penthouse.
Muldrew's on the 12th floor. His large window looks out at the market-rate Roslyn Lofts across the street. Like the Roslyn Hotel, it's a historic building with architectural swirls along the windows. Both buildings are topped with a giant red neon heart, a tribute to the Hart brothers who built the hotels 100 years ago. Muldrew's window also looks out onto the edge of Skid Row. It's where many of the men moving into the Roslyn today had been living. The SRO Housing Corporation is making it possible for them to move into comfortable homes. Anita Nelson is CEO of the nonprofit.
It's exciting because our residents, who are all low income and formerly homeless, never saw themselves being able to live in this part of downtown.
Her organization spent almost 2 years renovating the aging hotel.
1264.
Every time a resident gets a set of keys, the SRO staff bursts into applause. The Roslyn will also welcome about 200 others, among them people with mental illnesses and people who have been chronically homeless.
You have people who have stories where, you know, they haven't worked or they may have been addicted to drugs or alcohol. They're in recovery and now they have an opportunity to get stabilized.
It's the veterans who are moving in first in recognition of their service to the country. 56-year-old Lionel Muldrew served in the Army from 1979 to 1982. Dealing with nuclear missiles and traveling from Oklahoma to Germany to Russia. His last job was working as a hospital janitor. He got laid off about 6 years ago, and it was the last time he had his own apartment. Muldrew still needs to bring over his belongings, but he's already planning the furniture.
I'm gonna bring like four little chairs, a little table, you know, something I can, you know, sit down and just, you know, just have company then.
His first guest will be his niece, who he's just reconnected with after years of being homeless. Dana Beth Solomon, Annenberg Radio News.
California, yes now means yes, legally. Governor Jerry Brown made California the first state to define consent in campus sexual assault cases. The governor signed a bill stating active consent, which can be both verbal and physical signs, is needed for sexual activity. The bill requires campuses to adopt new sexual assault policies in order to receive state funds and requires training for some faculty. Many Los Angeles port truck drivers say they're carrying their weight in freight, while transport companies don't hold up their end of the bargain. Kevin Mallory explains what the controversy is all about.
The water at the Port of Long Beach is typically calm, but an ongoing struggle between transport companies and port truck drivers is making waves. Drivers feel they've been misclassified as independent contractors, even though they work 50 to 60 hours a week. Drivers contend this classification leaves them vulnerable to unfair wages. Teamsters Union representative Pablo Camacho says many truck drivers have reported having to cover operator expenses.
For example, insurance, registration on the vehicles, insurance on the vehicles, fuel for the operation of the vehicle, repairs of the vehicle.
Camacho says this has been a problem in the transport industry for years, and it's finally getting attention. He believes transport companies engage in these practices to protect their bottom lines.
They're patching the expenses, the operating expenses, onto the driver, but in reality, the driver has no stake in the company because the truck is not the driver's. The trucks are not under the driver's names. So basically, it's just a way for the company to evade paying taxes and paying unemployment insurance and just basic rights.
For truck driver Byron Monzon, this fight is not only about money and benefits, but recognition and appreciation.
We move all the stuff over here, but nobody respects over here. Nobody respects the driver. Nobody cares the driver. Nobody doing nothing to the driver. So that's why we want it.
Total Transportation Services Incorporated, known as TTSI, and Pacific Nine are two of the transport companies involved in the legal fight. TTSI refused to comment on the allegations, and Pacific Nine had no one available to comment. In the meantime, unions and truck drivers say they will continue to fight for drivers' reclassification as employees. Kevin Mallory, Annenberg Radio News.
USC's Keck School of Medicine announced today it will open a national center on elder abuse. The school won a multi-million dollar grant from the federal government to fund the project. USC estimates that 5 million senior citizens suffer a form of elder abuse each year. The center will work with community organizations to help prevent and respond to physical, sexual, and emotional abuse for senior citizens. Friday's water main break and subsequent flood is the third giant pipe burst in as many months. As Gabriel Cortez found out, here in L.A., such breaks are not as unusual as the headlines suggest.
Three. That's the number of breaks in major water mains that have grabbed headlines in the past 2 months. 3 to 4. That's the estimate of how many water mains break across Los Angeles every day. It's a common problem that can be seen in cities across the country, according to Charisma Say, professor of city and regional planning at the University of California, Berkeley.
It's not rare when you look at it nationally, and it's a sign of the age of our infrastructure and these long-delayed repairs.
According to estimates, the ruptured water main that flooded UCLA and Sunset Boulevard in July released 20 million gallons into the streets and destroyed more than 300 cars. But the damages created by minor water main breaks also have big ramifications.
We probably, because of pipe bursts and things like that, we probably lose millions of gallons a year because of that.
Exactly how much water? In New York City, whose water authority has almost as much pipeline and serves many more customers than LA's Department of Water and Power, the loss was significant.
They found that, I think 2 years ago, almost 30% of New York City's water that comes into the distribution system never actually gets to New York City users. So that's because of leakage, for sure, but also unaccounted for can count water that leaves through fire hydrants for fires or the Parks Department. So it's a lot of things that doesn't actually get to consumers, but leakage is a big part of that unaccounted for water rate.
Adam Foreman published a study last March for the Center for an Urban Future. The report was pretty bleak, but New York did differ in the number of pipes that broke.
Last year, we had over 500 water main breaks, so less than two per day. So if your figures for LA are 3 to 4 a day. That's significantly higher.
Pipe breaks can also be a lot more than a traffic nuisance.
One really big issue is that when water mains leak, they're actually affecting all the conduits around them.
And in the long run, those challenges may be just as costly. Gabriel Cortez, Annenberg Radio News.
It started to feel a lot more like fall this weekend, and it will stay cool tonight with a low of 64. But starting tomorrow, the high temperatures are going to be in the mid-80s. We're looking at two hot days in the 90s that might even climb into triple digits to close out the week. Looking ahead to game day, early reports are saying it's going to be in the 90s for Saturday's matchup against Arizona State at the Coliseum.
Grab that cash in both hands and make a stash.
Later on Annenberg Radio News, ESPN's Jonah Carey breaks down the Angels and Dodgers' postseason chances. Today is National Coffee Day. Caitlin Plummers tells us about the economics of the world's second biggest commodity.
Coffee lovers everywhere, turns out there's a lot more to your morning pick-me-up than what's in your cup. In honor of National Coffee Day, we decided to take a deeper look into America's favorite drink. Jason Remmer with International Coffee Trading gave us some insider info from the coffee trading market.
Lag between market conditions, and they have to be quite drastic, to where the consumer sees a difference. So
the majority of coffee is produced in developing countries like Brazil, and more than 25 million people make their living producing this hot commodity. Because of this, there's been a growing focus on how the industry treats the average coffee grower.
Fair trade's a very interesting concept on paper. I've seen some benefits to it, but I also see a lot of costs to it as well, where it does cost. If you want to be fair trade certified, you need to pay for that cost to your farm.
Keurig, a major player in the coffee market, says it's dedicated to helping coffee growers maintain their quality of life through difficult times.
So we work very closely, actually, with our coffee growing communities, not only to make sure that we're purchasing fair trade product, but we also continue to go back and work with our coffee communities during the dry months when they're not necessarily producing coffee, to make sure that they can find garnering an income and sustaining a living in the months when they're not necessarily producing coffee.
Speaking of dry seasons, one of the major coffee-producing regions is suffering a drought that's keeping the market in limbo.
Right now, the market seems to be treading water, waiting for more news out of Brazil since they had their drought crop this year. The number one coffee producer, about 40% of the world's consumed coffee comes from Brazil.
Although we're not seeing higher prices on coffee just yet, we asked some students on campus how much they would pay for a cup of coffee if it wasn't flowing as freely.
Hi, my name is Ian Lauritsen. I'm a second-year full-time MBA student. If there were no coffee left in the world, how much would I pay? It would probably be $100 for a cup of coffee.
Hi, I'm Carrie McMahon. I'm a junior at USC studying human performance and advertising. And if there is no more coffee in the world, I would probably pay $10 a cup.
Hi, I'm Forrest Dunlap. I'm a freshman studying computer engineering, computer science. And if there were no more coffee in the world, I'd probably pay a good $100 a cup if I was like the last cup of coffee.
Coffee addicts, don't worry. The price of made-to-order coffee drinks should stay the same, but make sure to remember the 25 million people who help you stay awake during class. Caitlin Plummer, Annenberg Radio News.
Several elementary school kids from all around South LA skipped school today to go on a little field trip to the Sunset Canyon tennis courts at UCLA. Camille Requiestas talked to all those involved to find out why.
Many children, like Shariah, are happy they aren't in school today. And the reason is,
I get to play tennis.
Teachers, coaches, and former tennis pro Pam Shriver taught students ages 5 and up the basics of tennis. The goal is to promote hard work and discipline. Angela Hookleys is the regional director for Up to Us, the nonprofit organization that hosted the event. She says sports teaches children important skills.
And we really believe that using a coach mentor and placing a caring adult relationship in a young person's life is so impactful for them and teaching them how to really learn life skills. And we use sports as that vehicle.
Not all elementary schools are equipped with tennis and basketball courts or soccer fields. Up to Us provides opportunities for kids to learn sports for free in locations throughout Los Angeles. Students are matched with a coach near their school or home, and each coach teaches the skills needed to play a certain sport. Up to Us offers over 750 sports programs, such as clinics and after-school activities, that teach sports like tennis, basketball, and soccer. Jacob Toops is program manager for Up to Us. He says children in South LA face daily hardships and traumas.
You have a kid that blows up or might be the bully on campus. Why are they a bully? There's something going on at home. You know, maybe that it's a family issue. Maybe they didn't grow up with a dad. Maybe they didn't grow up with a mom. Maybe they don't have a great, strong role model. So we're hoping that our coaches are trained in providing that for kids. Circumvent the trauma and start the healing process.
Some of the mentors and coaches have been through challenging experiences themselves. That's one of the main reasons they get involved in this program. Israel Frank is one of the mentors.
I actually encourage my kids to come tell me, like, what's going on, you know? Like, if they're having a bad day, come tell me. Like, I'm willing to talk to you. We can figure this out together.
He says mentoring gives him the opportunity to help kids achieve their goals, which is something he says he didn't have when he was younger. But today was about focusing on how to hit a ball with a tennis racket and fun footwork drills that had some students screaming.
Ready, one, two, three, go!
Some kids had other things in mind.
Can you have ice cream afterwards? That's the best question I've heard in a long time. I don't know the answer, but I'll try and get it.
Camille Requiestas, Annenberg Radio News.
Three, go!
The Major League Baseball postseason kicks off on Wednesday with the one-game wildcard playoffs. Both LA teams are strong World Series candidates, with the Angels earning the best record in baseball during the regular season. Jonah Carey is a New York Times best-selling author and lead baseball writer for Grantland.com. I asked him how he feels about the Angels making a deep run into the playoffs.
I don't feel good about them at all. I think their starting pitching is in trouble. They lost Garrett Richards. Matt Shoemaker looks promising. He's got an oblique injury. He threw a bullpen session. They're saying that there's a good chance he'll be able to make it back into the rotation, but that's a maybe. So you've got kind of one reliable starter in Jared Weaver. Wilson's been pretty shaky all year long. Who even knows the number four? And maybe Shoemaker's healthy. That makes me nervous. So the Angels obviously rolled up the best record in all baseball during the regular season, and that's great. But a lot of that was Richards and to some extent Shoemaker. And without that, even with the best offense in baseball, makes me wonder if they're going to be able to beat the much tougher competition in the postseason. I don't feel all that great about the World Series chances.
Heading on to the Dodgers, do you think this is the year that they overtake the Cards?
The Dodgers have a lot of stars. I mean, if you have Clayton Kershaw going up against anybody, you have to like your chances. But it's sort of a little bit of a stars and scrubs team. They've got some weaknesses on the roster, particularly in the bullpen. Kenley Jansen is a great closer, but to get to Kenley Jansen, it's rough. You know, so we're going to have to see Kershaw go really deep into games and Greinke go really deep into games. And then maybe Dan Haren and Ryu do the same. And it's possible. I mean, that could certainly happen. But then, you know, I'm not 100% positive that's going to necessarily be the case.
And so we got the wild card games coming up. Who do you have in the AL wild card, KC or Oakland?
Again, one game, so it's pretty much flipping a coin. And, you know, we can draw out whatever insight we want, but it's a small sample and absolutely anything can happen. You know, having said that, I think Oakland was a good shot at it. People are maybe overreacting a little bit to the way that they fell off in the second half. The theory is, oh, they traded Cespedes, they're no good anymore. But there were all these unlucky things that happened. There were a couple of injuries or a bunch of slumps and whatever. But if you look at it and you say, well, this is the best team in baseball 2 months ago, and they acquired Lester and Samardzija, how is it that they're so bad now? I don't think they're bad now. I think they just happen to be playing poorly heading into the playoffs. I think they have a chance to win this wild card game against Kansas City. And not only that, I think if they get into a situation where they're in the ALDS and ALCS or whatever, they have a pretty good chance to win the pennant.
Heading over to the NL wild card, how about my Buccos? Do you think they have a chance to make a splash in the postseason?
Volquez has had a pretty good season from the superficial statistical standpoint. He's got a low ERA and pretty good one-loss record and so forth. Not the best pitcher, though. I mean, he really does benefit a lot from defense. The Pirates do bail him out quite a bit. He walks too many guys, too many wild pitches, whatever. So he's susceptible to some damage, especially against a better team. And the Giants are a better team. And when you look at Madison Bumgarner going for the Giants, I mean, that is their ace. They managed to line up their best pitcher for this game. So, you know, if you're just talking about the little advantages, I would go San Francisco. But the game is in Pittsburgh. And again, it's one game and anything can happen. And the best team doesn't necessarily win. I think the Giants might be a slightly better team than the Pirates are. But that means virtually nothing.
Who's your ultimate pick to win the World Series?
Just in terms of where the teams are right now, where they're positioned, the Nationals look better than anybody else, but the margins are so slim. You could take that for whatever it's worth with my pick to win the World Series, but honestly, the only reasonable way to judge whether a person knows what they're talking about or not is to look at the preseason picks.
Jonah, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Cheers, thanks very much.
That was Jonah Carey, author of Up, Up, and Away, A History of the Montreal Expos. You can hear my full interview with him on our website, annenbergradio.org. A new study says children who exercise for an hour a day have a much easier time paying attention and multitasking. Alana Victor reports.
1 hour out of a 24-hour day can make a difference in a child's ability to concentrate. That is, if the child is exercising up to 60 minutes sometime during the day. The study was conducted at the University of Illinois. Dr. Charles Hillman, the lead researcher, studied children between 7 and 9 years old.
Kids get better at that around the age of, 7, 8 years old, and so we have to wait until they sort of have the basic level of brain maturation before we can engage in those tasks.
The children participated in these groups for 9 months before their mental function was tested. Kids placed in the active group program performed short bursts of exercise interspersed with rest over a two-hour period. They got 70 minutes of physical activity on average in a group setting, which mimicked their natural environment. Dr. Hillman says the findings were threefold.
We basically had three findings out of the study. The first is that physical activity is related to changes in brain function that are related to attention and working memory and cognitive flexibility, which is really multitasking.
The other findings showed that after the exercise, children improved their tasks that required more attention. The results show the increase in physical activity, which led to an increase in mental performance.
We're surprised by the linear relationship that we saw, really showing that the more they attended the intervention, the greater the improvement was. It's really an interesting, unique finding that we weren't expecting.
Dr. Hillman hopes this study gets more kids up and moving and just maybe paying a little more attention. Alana Victor, Annenberg Radio News.
The Gamble House, a historical home in Pasadena, is getting a new twist this week. An arts organization is bringing the building to life with performance art for the city's Axis Festival. Stephanie Case toured the house and has more.
A trip to the Gamble House is a unique experience. Walk up the front stairs and you're handed blue plastic booties that look like shower caps to pull over your shoes.
Here you go. Put them over your shoe, your boot.
It seems odd, but it's all to preserve the pristine, century-old hardwood floors. For guests, the first step inside is breathtaking.
For me, I respond to how dark and romantic it is, and it's so overwhelming, and it's a masterpiece. It's so beautiful.
That's Elizabeth Klein, the assistant director of Machine Project, an arts collective from Echo Park. For 2 weeks, Klein and her group are transforming the space, embedding live performances, poetry, dance, and art into each room of the Gamble House for the public to see. It's an ambitious concept, but Machine Project is no stranger to taking over unconventional spaces.
We're known for doing a lot of site-specific projects out in museums or parking lots or swimming pools or helicopters or things all over. And it was a really interesting challenge to do something within a work of art.
Machine Project took the house, a work of art in itself, and enlivened it. Videos are projected on the walls of a linen closet. Dancer Nick Duran performs up and down the main staircase. Open one closet door, and a poet is there, waiting to read a poem for only you to hear. And in the downstairs bedroom, artists lounge in twin beds, wearing bathrobes and sweatpants, hair must. Their performance is called Bed Conversations, and they lie there, riffing about everything and anything, from texting habits to Chinese food. Guests sit cross-legged and kneel by the beds to watch and to laugh at the flowing chatter. Monique Harris was there.
It's almost like you're watching somebody just living in the house and watching them converse while you're there, which is a little bit weird, but also kind of awesome.
This was Harris's second visit to the home, and the new art brought her back, allowing her to experience the historical space from a fresh perspective.
The Gamble House and historic homes traditionally have this been there, done there problem where you only go once because you feel like you've seen it and you've experienced all there is to do. And so this idea that we could enliven it or highlight things through the artist's lens that maybe the docents or the historians don't highlight.
One highlight, a colorful projection of light dancing on the opaque glass windows of the dining room, struck Harris with its beauty.
Just seeing it morph across the glass and make the glass come alive at first I was like, wait, was that happening when I was here the last time? And then I'm like, wow, that's gorgeous.
Machine Project's stay at the Gamble House runs through the week. Stephanie Case, Annenberg Radio News.
Social media has become an integral part of human expression. Facebook has 1.3 billion users, and Twitter generates about 500 million tweets per day. Social media is at the center of David Rousseff's Stardust. Christina Campodinico watched the performance this weekend at the Carpenter Performing Arts Center and has this review.
The central character of Stardust never appears on stage. His name is Junior, a gay African-American urban teen who is only known through his online presence. He sends tweets to God and posts anonymous text messages to the internet. Choreographer, writer, and director David Rousseff combines Junior's social media messages with modern dance to illustrate this young man's coming of age. Junior's texts are written in a youthful shorthand of Ebonic syntax, IM abbreviations, and urban lingo. They appear as projections on a screen backdrop. With a ping and a chirp, they populate the newsfeed of Junior's harsh life in stark black and white lettering. One post relays how his crush and nemesis, football player Big Man D, knocks out Junior's front teeth. Another documents how his foster father, Mr. Collins, molests him in a drunken rage. Such moments, raw, violent, and unfiltered, never receive a shocked reply or a comment of outrage. The internet serves as a repository for Junior's unsettling tweets, but it is no sounding board, nor does it talk back. But Junior's disembodied messages do find a sympathetic ear in the impassioned movements of David Rousseff's dance company, Reality. Rousseff's dancers embody every register on the teen's emotional scale, from his emoticon tears to his smiley faces. When Junior learns of his grandfather's death, a dancer heaves into an overpowering conniption fit, and every dancer swoons in huge body spirals when the boy ponders romance. In all, Rousseff's emotive choreography cuts through the clutter of the information age, striking the nerve that motivates us all to go online, the deep need to be heard, and the strong hope that someone out there might be listening. Reality's national tour of Stardust concludes in Seattle in November. Christina Campodonico, Annenberg Radio News.
Now it's time to hear the sounds of another place that's uniquely Los Angeles.
My name is Natalie, and this is my partner,
Lupita.
And we were here on the alleys on 11 and 12 in Maple. Sandals, backpacks, we sell clothes. And anytime you guys want to come and shop here, this is boutique, Picky Boutique, really good price. You know, we give good customer service, and we wish everybody can come and shop here.
Now we check in with Emily Thornburg to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision. Emily, what do you got for us?
Yeah, we have a couple big stories coming out today. We have the Governor Jerry Brown, who just signed that new rape prevention policy, so we got a lot of student reactions on that. Big thing on USC's campus. And we're also doing a new thing. It's called the A Report. These will be stories by students at Annenberg. And we have a student who actually went into LAPD Patrol, Air Patrol. So we have an inside look at that.
All right, sounds good. And that's it for this Monday. We had help today from Megan Coyle, Sarah Tiano, Karina Hologin. Our board operator is Derek Renfro, Sean Birch is the newscast producer, and the executive producer is Andy Vasoyan. For all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Charlie McGovern.